From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Senate is expected to vote today on a $2 trillion emergency relief bill considered the largest in U.S. history. It would send money to hospitals, expand unemployment benefits, and give a one-time payment to many Americans, among other things. Meanwhile, in New York, now the epicenter of the crisis in the United States, that bill did not get high marks from Governor Andrew Cuomo, who today called it troublesome. He said he wants to see more federal help for his state. We are joined now by New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson. Speaker, thank you for joining us. And what do you think of the Senate bill? And is it going to be enough for the state of New York and the city of New York?
Thanks for having me. I haven't had an opportunity at this point to review all the specifics on the bill. But what I do know is that we are going to need not just a few billion dollars, we are going to need tens of billions of dollars. We are now the epicenter, not just in the United States, but potentially the world. And our economy affects the rest of the country's economy. And so the money that we're seeing that's going to come in, we want to make sure it's not just going to go to the big corporations, but it's going to reach workers. It's going to reach small businesses. The MTA, which is our transportation authority here, needs $4 billion. Our hospitals need tens of billions of dollars. So I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but if Governor Cuomo is saying that he is alarmed, that's not a good sign. And I look forward to reviewing it to figure out what else we need to advocate for New York City. And then lastly, I just want to say, we want to make sure that no one is left behind. What do I mean by that? Gig economy workers, domestic workers, freelancers, people that don't typically qualify for unemployment insurance, small businesses. In New York City, they're the backbone of our economy, and we want to make sure that these dollars are going to their pockets as well.
The governor also said today that the city's density control measures may be working. He cited statistics showing that the increase in hospitalizations may be slowing. Listen.
That is almost too good to be true. But the theory is, given the density that we're dealing with, it spreads very quickly. But if you reduce the density, you can reduce the spread very quickly.
Cory Johnson, do you think that all the social distancing in the world can help a city as dense as New York? And do you think it's working?
I think it is extraordinarily important, and it's the most important thing that New Yorkers can be doing right now. We basically have three crises that are going on simultaneously. The first is the transmission that is still occurring and the fact that we need to halt it. The second, which we need to do simultaneously, is to increase our hospital capacity, our personal protective equipment stockpile, getting more ventilators, doing those two things at once so that the crest of the wave is not as big as it might be. And the third is delivering dollars into the pockets of New Yorkers who are economically ruined overnight. Those are the three things. I'll say that I think the governor has been extraordinarily effective at leveling with New Yorkers in a calm, measured, thoughtful way on a daily basis. And he's brought a lot of comfort to people by giving them instructions on what they can do to make a difference on a daily basis.
Finally, let me just ask you, what do you think of President Trump's comments that he wants to see things reopened by Easter?
I really don't even know how he came up with a date like that. You really can't reopen the economy in a full way if you have people who are overwhelming the healthcare system or folks that are scared to be around each other. So I think the most important thing to do is level with people and to give people realistic expectations. We need to listen to public health experts. We need to listen to Dr. Fauci. There may be measures we can take to ease some restrictions on folks who recover from the coronavirus and get them back to work. But we shouldn't be giving people a false sense of hope. We need to go by the public health experts. And then lastly, I just want to say, we need to give folks hope, though. And the hope that I want to give New Yorkers is we got through 9/11. We got through the fiscal crisis of the 1970s. We got through Hurricane Sandy. This is a painful, difficult, hard time for New York, but we will get through this. We are one New York. We can do it together.
New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's check in Georgia now, where over 1,200 people have tested positive for the coronavirus. 40 have died from the disease it causes, COVID-19. Stephen Fowler is with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, at least 50% of Americans are under stay-at-home orders. Georgia hasn't issued one. Why not?
Well, Robin, see, Georgia has been a little bit slower to enact these things because there are a lot of rural parts of the state where the economy needs to keep going and that there aren't that many cases. But what Governor Brian Kemp has done has ordered people who are deemed medically fragile, cancer patients, older Georgians, to stay at home for a couple weeks and has shut down bars. But so far, that's about all of the statewide restrictions that have happened.
Well, experts caution that there may not be cases there now, but there will soon be. Georgia did put off its presidential primary yesterday, though. What's happening instead?
Well, Georgia postponed the presidential primary until a May federal primary date because a lot of poll workers in Georgia are older and there's concerns about the virus spreading. And yesterday, the Secretary of State did say that every active registered voter in Georgia will get an absentee ballot application so that they can send that back and vote by mail if they want to avoid voting in person. But in-person voting should still be an option.
Very briefly, we know in Southwest Georgia, you had one person attending two funerals and started a hot spot. Just briefly, what do we know there?
Well, right now, Phoebe Putney Memorial Hospital in Albany in Southwest Georgia says they have at least 150 cases that they've tested positive. 1,000 people are waiting for tests, and the disease is spreading through that community because restrictions weren't put in place in time.
Well, yes, as we said, reporter Stephen Fowler with Georgia Public Broadcasting giving us a sense of what's going on in that state, which has not declared stay-at-home orders yet for its residents. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
And grocery store employees are just some of the workers on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic, putting their health at risk to keep us all stocked up with food and other essentials. Some grocery chains are offering employees an additional $2 an hour, but many workers are asking for hazard pay and COVID-19 testing. Noah Glick from member station KUNR in Reno, Nevada reports.
Walk into many grocery stores these days and you'll see two things, lines and empty shelves.
Looking down the bread aisle, the bread is completely picked over with the exception of some organic English muffins, and it looks like some gluten-free artisan baker bread. One thing I'm noticing, though, is people are not abiding by the 6-foot rule from the CDC. There's definitely no way to do social distancing here at this grocery store.
While many businesses are shutting down to help stop the spread of COVID-19, grocery stores don't have that luxury. And the people that work there, like cashiers, don't really make that much. At most, about $15 an hour. But like healthcare workers, they're considered essential.
My employees, I'll tell you, have been great. I can't commend them enough.
That's Bill Presswood. He's the grocery manager at Village Market in Incline Village, Nevada.
We have provided some hand sanitizer stations up front. We do have Clorox. We have different products up there. And so I think they feel pretty comfortable.
Presswood says for the last few weeks, the store has implemented new cleaning standards to try and keep the virus at bay.
I do have two new people I hired just for today to help out up front bagging and to help out wiping down shopping carts and door handles and such.
The store is also dealing with an influx of customers.
In all these years, I've never seen anything like this.
That's Pam DeJean, one of the store's cashiers. She says no one really knows what's going to happen next, so their only option is to clean as much as possible.
Until they really continue the research and find some sort of treatment or vaccine that's effective, this is the best we can do.
Still, DeJean says she's never even questioned whether or not she should show up for work, even though she says her and her husband are both in a high-risk group.
The community here, they need people to be here at the store. Everyone needs supplies and groceries.
Now, grocery stores aren't really special in terms of disease transmission.
It's just a place we have to go, so there's that potential to be in contact with other people.
That's Brian Labus. He's an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
So for the people working there, any risk would be dealing directly with customers. So if you're touching items that they're touching, like something on the checkout machine, or you're handing money back and forth or things like that, those kind of things can be contaminated with the virus and it can be passed on to the worker that's there.
So right now, being a cashier could be a hazardous job, and many workers are asking for hazard pay. Dan Kalish is a managing partner at HKM Employment Attorneys.
If you don't don't have a collective bargaining agreement or separate agreement for hazard pay, then generally no local, state, or federal law really provides it at this time.
It's a difficult time for cashier Pam DeJean, and she says it's difficult for everyone.
The customers, the employees, all of us, we're all concerned because we don't know what's going to happen next.
Until we know what's going to happen next, here's what we do know. It's important to wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and maintain at least 6 feet of distance between people, all of which is a bit harder when you're busy working at the local supermarket. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick in Reno, Nevada.
And Noah's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Even during normal times, people tend to make decisions that go against their best interests, and we are not living in normal times right now. So what effect does this uncertainty have on decisions we're making now? Decisions about things like what and how much to buy at the grocery store, and more complicated issues of protecting public health and the economy. Joining us now is Dan Ariely, who's a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. He's also the author of a number of books, including Predictably Irrational. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, and a lot of your research focuses on the way we predictably make the wrong decisions in our lives without realizing it. We go against our best interests. As you're watching the coronavirus pandemic unfold, what wrong decisions are you seeing people make?
There's, of course, many. One of them, of course, is the slowness in recognizing a pandemic, right? We have things that kind of develop in exponential pace, and when we see them early days, we say, it's nothing. The second one is precautions, right? So in general, we're not very good at precautions. We text and drive, you know, the flu season affects everybody on a regular year. And we don't pay much attention to things that will happen in the future, even if this future is 2 weeks from now. And we don't pay much attention to things that are invisible, like viruses. So you see even, you know, undergrads partying on the beach as a consequence. And then, of course, there's another one, which is that we do what is selfishly good for us and not what good for other people necessarily. So people who are supposed to stay at home because they might be sick, get very bored, and they go out and contaminate other people. And then there's another issue, which is, of course, that, you know, the industry of fake news has been so successful, in some sense, undermining news and reporting and so on, that in quite a few countries, including the U.S., we see people who no longer believe the media. And now you have another group of people who are basically believing that this is a conspiracy or not the right thing or no need to worry. And of course, those people are creating risk for everybody.
But I mean, I think one of the core things you just talked about there, it goes against what needs to be done in a pandemic, which is to put the individual aspect of our lives aside and think about the greater good, because a lot of what individuals can do right now may not benefit them, but it will benefit other people.
Yeah. You know, this is what we call public goods problems. These are things that when we pull together, we could do much better. And what's interesting about public goods problems is as long as everybody participates, everybody gets a lot of benefit. And when people start defecting or betraying the public good, lots of bad things happen. And in a situation like pandemic, it's enough that a small percentage of people don't adhere to the rules and they can hurt everybody. So this is why you see hoarding of toilet papers.
Why toilet paper, by the way? Why is toilet paper so important to people right now?
So I think it's a little random, but one of the things that we find is very easy to create in the lab, and we see it a lot in the world, is to create what we call a bubble, where a behavior goes in a particular way and it exacerbates itself. So, you know, if you go to the grocery store, the supermarket, and there's only half as many toilet paper as you, when the shelves are only half full, you basically say to yourself, this must be something I need to get very quickly. And let me get a lot of it so I don't run out. And then the next person sees less and less and less. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So what about the sort of dilemma that many people are seeing right now, including President Trump, which is that you've got this health crisis and you've also got an economic crisis at the same time. And he says he doesn't want the cure to be worse than the problem itself. He says he wants to reopen the country by Easter, which is just a few weeks away. And if you look at the graphs of where we are and how far behind Italy we are, you know, in a few weeks we could be facing what Italy is facing right now. What about that dilemma of trying to balance the economy and the health part of it?
The sad reality is that we've always had a trade-off between money and saving lives. This is not something new. We know the cost of saving life by creating better transportation. We know the cost of improving quality of life, for example, by reducing poverty or giving people jobs and so on. So this trade-off between money and life and money and health and money and well-being has always been in society. And I think the question is, are we making trade-offs now under a state of panic that we wouldn't have done in a regular day? I think this perspective of saying, you know, if we spend X money here to eradicate this, are we killing more people on the other hand because we'll not have money for something else? I have to say that I'm very grateful that I'm an academic and I can think about those dilemmas but not make life and death decisions about, you know, for other people. But these are some of the hard decisions we have to face.
What would your one piece of advice as a behavioral economist be to all of us who are making decisions based on what's going on right now?
There's lots of things to say, right? Don't look at your portfolio. It's not going to help. Don't read the news before noon. Try to do something useful. This is also going to be with us for a while. And, you know, when you have a change in lifestyle, it's an opportunity and a danger. And it's an opportunity to start new habits, new routines like exercise, eat better, spend time with your family. It's also an opportunity to start worse habits like not exercising, overeating, developing addiction to social media and the news. So I think it's a really good time to say, you know, we have this dramatic change in our lives. Let's try to figure out what do we do personally on it to take advantage in terms of our work habits, in terms of our family habits, our leisure habits, and so on.
That is Dan Ariely, who is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and author of a number of books, including Predictably Irrational. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Well, if you're cooped up at home and you have kids, here's a question. Is it safe for the kids to play outside? The Allegheny Front's Andy Kubis reports.
This is what my house sounds like lately. I have two boys, 8 and 10. We live in the city with a tiny backyard. There is a trampoline, mercifully, but getting outside to wide open spaces is what they really need. My friend Reiko Yamamoto, who also has two boys, feels the same.
The kids get to run around like they always do. And also, it gives me a sense of normalcy.
Over the past week or so, Reiko's family and my family have been meeting up to play basketball at the park or on trails around Pittsburgh for evening hikes.
That was a big splash.
We thought we were following the guidelines, staying 6 feet apart, not letting the kids touch each other.
I guess we can't high five, so you ready for this?
Air yeah. Five.
We weren't sure about everything. Could the kids play on the super cool nature playground? Should they be playing together at all?
It's wood. I don't think coronavirus is on wood, so.
Turns out we were doing it wrong.
Going outside and interacting with people who are not in your household is a bad idea.
This is Anita McElroy. She's a pediatric infectious disease doctor at UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh.
These are all recommendations that are being made based upon the data that are available. And every day we have new data that we're learning. So I would say if you can maintain contact with just your family unit, that is absolutely the safest, most conservative approach.
McElroy says getting outside is important and safe as long as we are all clear on the latest guidelines from public health officials. Playgrounds of any material, it's best to stay away.
So anything that other people might touch after having coughed or sneezed into their hands are potential sources of infection.
This advice has been supported by new research published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Scientists found that the coronavirus can survive on hard surfaces such as plastic and stainless steel for up to 72 hours and on cardboard for up to 24. Infectious disease experts still think that the main way the virus spreads is through person-to-person contact. But on March 18th, Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force talked about the new research on surface contamination and said the public should be very cautious.
We're still working out how much is it by human-human transmission and how much is it by surface. And this is why those fundamental guidelines were put out that says don't expose yourself to surfaces outside the home.
But what about the air? How long can the virus live there? Say someone with the virus is on a hiking trail and sneezes before you walk through. Are you at risk?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to answer because there's no way to know the volume of air moving through a hiking trail at any one point in time.
Still, McElroy says the chances of you having an exposure from someone who isn't directly in front of you, coughing or sneezing, is very minimal.
Hence why we say maintain 6 feet of distance. So even if someone did cough or sneeze, you'd still have some theoretical protection.
This is all to say, go outside. But remember, this is an evolving situation, and you definitely shouldn't head out if you or anyone in your family is sick.
All right, you guys got your stuff?
Uh-huh.
Today, my family is getting ready for a day trip to Cook Forest in northwestern Pennsylvania.
Where are my hiking boots?
Hiking is one of our favorite things to do, and I'm hoping the Cathedral Forest with its 100-year-old hemlocks will help us all feel better.
Hey, Dad, did you get the trail mix?
Hey, guys, don't forget to go to the bathroom.
For Here and Now, I'm Andy Kubis.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
And in Honduras, one of the world's most impoverished countries, doctors say the challenges fighting COVID-19 are overwhelming. Official cases number about 30. Everyone feels it's higher. Dr. Victor Flores is in the capital, Tegucigalpa. And doctor, you're on lockdown, but you say information is on lockdown. What do you mean?
We don't have any data on suspected cases, on how many tests that are available. We have very little information on what the public health system is actually looking at right now.
Yeah. Well, now we should say again, you're on lockdown, but you've heard from others who are still able to treat patients. What are they seeing when it comes to COVID-19?
They're seeing patients that come in with really high fevers, coughs, and because we don't have tests right now in the country, they are being sent home and told to isolate. Still, the markets are crowded and there is lack of food. We're facing a situation where we don't have the capacity to attend to a wave of COVID-19.
Well, it's not just that you're fighting COVID-19. You already had the health challenge, dengue.
In 2019, we had more than 100,000 cases and 180 deaths. And 2020, we have 10,000 cases of dengue, and we have no water in the capital. People are forced to store water, so the vector is living among us.
And what kind of things do you have there to fight COVID-19? Start with respirators.
Recently, the government bought 140 respirators, they claimed. And when they got to Honduras, we realized that they were BiPAP systems. This would instead spread more of the virus. So it's a very delicate situation in which the more infected people and the more they go to a public hospital, the more they're prone to keep spreading this virus. And if they get complicated, we don't have the ICUs with the other crisis we have going on. There is a shortage of gowns, masks, every sort of material to keep doctors from this virus. And we are getting infected, and we are also a mode of transmission as well for our families and for the other rest of patients we're seeing in the hospital.
By the way, I think it's just so crazy that your government ordered machines that were not respirators, and only 3 hospitals in the capital, most people aren't insured. What has to happen?
First of all, I would start with putting a doctor in charge of this whole situation. So the government basically is distancing from the Honduran College of Doctors. Recently, a $450 million budget was approved for this crisis. And the claim was they were going to build 95 hospitals, but Honduras hasn't built a hospital in the last 30 years. So the government is not being transparent.
Dr. Flores, Victor, you're planning to go back in the field to treat patients. As we said, you're on lockdown right now. But how are you preparing for that if you don't have gowns or masks or gloves?
We have to, I guess, just prepare by taking our own cautions, buying our own masks, buying our own gowns, so that we can protect and protect others, and identifying cases and reporting.
Dr. Victor Flores, speaking to us from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Boy, as the COVID-19 spreads there, they only have 12 respirators. Dr. Flores, we wish you all the best.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, well, even in the midst of this very strange time with the coronavirus, we want to stick to some old traditions that might make you feel good. And this one is the DJ sessions. And today, a nice, calming, classical music edition of the Here and Now DJ sessions. Kate Remington is the music director at WSHU Public Radio in Fairfield, Connecticut. She is with us once again. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Jeremy. It's great to have a chance to talk to you again.
Well, it's nice to talk to anybody right now, I feel like, given that we're all separated from each other. Now, you're actually in the station, right?
Yeah, we're in the studio. We're kind of in a, not a lockdown exactly, but a very minimal staff. So I feel pretty safe here.
It's good to have you with us. And the last time you came, you brought us some of your favorite video game music, which people can check out at hereandnow.org. But typically you host a classical music show, which is kind of perfect for right now. And let's get to some of the music you brought us. This is called Eclogue for Piano and Orchestra. This is by Gerald Finzi. Sounds very hopeful, Kate. Tell us why you picked this one.
I love this piece. In the 10 minutes that it takes to listen to it, it's like having a guided meditation, really. It starts out very quietly, and it just takes you through a lot of emotions, but it never gets you to the point where you become really anxious. And it just, I think, it's very reassuring to listen to.
And tell us more about Gerald Finzi.
He's a really interesting guy. He kind of is overshadowed by Ray Vaughan Williams. They lived and worked in England around the same time. Finzi was not as a go-getting professional as Vaughan Williams, but his music is very similar in that it really reflects the British countryside and pastoral pursuits. In fact, the title of this piece, Eclogue, actually means a sort of a pastoral piece, so you can imagine an English countryside as you're listening to it.
Mm-hmm. The next one you brought us is The Rain. This is originally by Joe Hisaishi, but this performance is by Angèle Dubois.
Thank you.
why performers choose to play music and record it, I think, is so much a part of it. Angèle Dubaud was going through some treatment for breast cancer, and once she successfully battled that, she put together this album of the music that helped her get through that really tough time. And it's such an interesting collection of pieces, and one of the ones that she included is this work by Joe. And it's just refreshing. It's just uplifting, and it makes you feel really great just to listen to it.
And tell us more about Joe Hisaishi.
He's an interesting composer. He's written a lot of music for Studio Ghibli films like Princess Mononoke, and also music for the concert stage. And I think he just has such an interesting way of using harmonies and melodies. It's very modern sounding, and yet it's almost, you know, kind of hard to place in a particular era.
All right, the next one that you have brought us is very old. This is an instrumental piece by Hildegard of Bingen. So how old is this piece?
It's about 900 years old, and I think there's just something really comforting about hearing music from that long ago. It really helps me put things into perspective because, you know, mm-hmm. it kind of gives you the long view of life and humanity, I guess.
And 900 years, by the way, is even before the Black Death, the bubonic mm-hmm. plague, started to be a problem. So
yeah.
This is very old. And what about Hildegard of Bingen? What should we know about Hildegard of Bingen?
She was fascinating. She was just a powerhouse. She headed up an abbey, but also was a mystic, a composer, a writer. And other feudal lords in medieval Germany would come to her for advice. So in a way, she was kind of like a diplomatic leader as well.
Okay, the next one that you've brought us is called So Let Us Melt, Millions and Millions. This is by Jessica Curry. Listen. Kate, there's something about listening to all of these that makes me think everything is going to be all right.
That was my intent. That's what I think about every day mm-hmm. when I put together the music that I share with our listeners. Jess's music just comes from this wellspring of incredible joy, I think, and comfort. And she wrote this work for a Google Daydream virtual reality game in which these thinking machines create wonderful, safe worlds for people to live on. And it's just so uplifting to listen to.
Okay, well, the last one that we have time for is Mozart. This is Clarinet Concerto Adagio, performed here by John Manis. just beautiful. And it sounds like maybe the perfect thing to, as you peer out the window to see if it's safe to go outside yet, this is what you could be listening to.
Oh, absolutely. I was just thinking it's like the musical equivalent of a hug. I mean, it just says so much in such a simple way. These melodies aren't complex at all, but every time I listen to it, I can just feel my nerve endings kind of unclenching and stretching out and smoothing out. It's one of my go-to pieces.
Well, and those green shoots coming out of the ground as we get into spring, and there's new life coming as well, and we'll get through this, and music is probably going to be a huge help.
I think so. I hope so.
That is Kate Remington, who's music director at WSHU Public Radio in Fairfield, Connecticut. Kate, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And you can, of course, find us on Spotify. We are NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music, and you can find all these pieces at hereandnow.org.
So it's been pretty well established that coronavirus is upending daily life for tens of millions of Americans. Schools and businesses closed, people working at home are far more important, out of work, doctors and nurses overwhelmed. The virus is also threatening neighborhoods already handling another menacing threat, gun violence, and it's disrupting efforts to curb that violence. Vaughn Bryan is executive director of the Chicago anti-violence group Communities Partnering for Peace. Vaughn, first tell us a bit about the work you do when things are normal.
So what we do when things are normal is we canvass communities with what we call credible messengers who are from those particular communities, looking for guys who we know are vulnerable to gun violence and try to build a relationship with them and help them turn their lives around.
And, you know, I apologize because I shouldn't even use the word normal. That should not be accepted as normal, you know, but that has become something at least that seems normal in comparison to what we're dealing with now. And we know that Illinois is one of several states under some kind of lockdown to slow the spread of COVID-19. But your outreach workers have been deemed essential?
They have been. So anyone who's really working on the front lines of health and safety for the city are deemed exempt from the lockdown. And, you know, our guys have uniforms. They provide an essential public service. We know that conflicts amongst, you know, people who are in vulnerable communities are not going to stop because of COVID-19.
Well, do you worry that they'll be exacerbated with people who, you know, maybe can't go to work or school, are now confined in closer quarters with people that they have, you know, a problem with? Do you worry it's going to get worse?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that COVID-19 is going to exacerbate it. We really don't know. This is an unprecedented time. And I'm not sure the population that we're really seeking are people who go to school on a regular basis anyway, or are in the legal economy. So from that perspective, you know, there's not really a change.
We do understand that one of the things that your workers will do, and this seems smart when the city of Chicago said they were essential, they're also, if they're going out in the community, bringing with them word of how to fight the coronavirus.
Yeah, so we want to educate the community on what it really is so people take it seriously and really take the lockdown seriously. Really, the safest thing you can do, no matter what lot in life, is to really just stay indoors right now or stay close to home and away from other people. And so we feel like, you know, we're in those communities and we're just as credible as anyone to send that message on behalf of the city.
Well, and a lot of these people are young adults. We've seen young adults on spring break in Florida completely disregard these warnings. How are they taking it in your neighborhood?
It remains to be seen. In some neighborhoods, it's dormant, not a lot of people out. And then there's other neighborhoods, you know, people are business as usual. I don't know that there's a method to it or a reason why certain communities take it versus others, but there's, you know, no real distinction on, you know, who's taken seriously and who's not.
You know, Vaughn, I'm finding myself thinking that, you know, gun violence is just, you know, it makes your blood run cold to think of somebody feeling like they're being stalked by somebody with a gun or targeted by somebody with a gun. What a horrible feeling.
And yeah, that, I mean, it's not a good way to live. And, you know, the whole goal of our work is to, you know, relentlessly pursue and build trusting relationships with those individuals and those groups and to really, you know, mobilize resources to help them heal and help our communities heal.
Well, and now maybe Americans who don't know that feeling maybe have a sense of it because they're being stalked by this unseen enemy.
Yeah, and there's a feeling of insecurity based on the unknown and potentially coming past somebody who has the virus or, you know, yeah, there's just a lot of unknowns. And so that's a very insecure, unstable way to live. And no American should live that way, whether it's COVID-19 or, you know, some of the systemic challenges that have created, some, you know, our vulnerable communities that we live with today.
Yeah. Well, Von Brian, again, executive director of the Chicago Anti-Violence Group, Communities Partnering for Peace. Their outreach workers have been deemed essential services by the city of Chicago. So they're still going to try to go out and use their anti-violent measures in neighborhoods there in Chicago. Well, we wish you the best of luck. Are you concerned about your outreach workers because they're not getting to isolate?
Yeah, we are. And so we have a set of measures that we're taking, some safeguards to make sure that, you know, they're not out on the street in the same way. So instead of walking the communities, we would prefer them to be in the car. We're going to use the same social distance recommendations that the CDC has put out, keeping 6 feet of distance, limiting our interaction to 10 minutes, not shaking hands, wearing gloves. And we'll just proceed accordingly with those things in mind.
Yeah. And it strikes me that you're doing the work first and foremost for your anti-violence measures. But in this time of this extra stressor, you know, people must appreciate somebody coming to see them.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Our goal is going to be the same with COVID or without COVID. We're really trying to get guys and gals to turn their lives around and take some of the services that we offer, whether that's behavioral health, job readiness training. We subsidize GED attainment. We're really trying to move people's lives forward because we believe if they take those services and really embrace them, there's less incentive to go back to life in the illegal economy.
Well, I hope that they can soon take those services. Vaughn, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's amazing the reach of this virus. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.